when the time is right, investors will do their job and would, move heaven and earth to try to meet you. The very first investor who reached out to us, we had set up a Twitter page. He DM'd our Twitter page and did not get, we weren't really paying attention to it because it was just three of us, me and my two other co-founders. So we weren't really on our Twitter page. We didn't get a response to that. He went to our privacy policy on our website, found our privacy email. So it was something like privacy@keeper.africa. He sent an email to that email, like, please connect me with Kennedy or whoever the founders are. And that was how he reached out to us, and he's been one of our most supportive investors.
Today, I'm speaking with Kennedy Ekeze, the founder and CEO of Keeper, a financial management startup for businesses in Africa. During our conversation, he shared his experiences raising capital as a first-time founder, how he chose his investors, and some of his lessons from this process. Let's get into it.
Welcome, Kennedy.
Thank you.
How are you doing today?
Feeling pretty good. It's been a long day, but feeling good.
Okay. So, fun fact, you're the first alumni of University of Calabar I'm having here.
Oh, fun. University of Calabar never makes the list, so it's my personal mission to put Unical on the map.
Yeah. All right, so we are going to get into our conversation. We're starting out with getting a personal background of yourself.
Sure.
So can you share, let our audience meet you, who is Kennedy?
Yeah, as I guess most people know, I'm Kennedy Ekezie, co-founder and CEO at Keeper. We are an all-in-one financial management solution for small businesses. I was born here in Lagos. My family moved to Calabar when I was 8. My parents are teachers, or were teachers at the time. And we got jobs, my parents got jobs in Calabar. So we moved there. I went to secondary school in Calabar. I went to University of Calabar. And I spent most of my formative years growing up in Calabar. After Calabar, I moved to Beijing for 2 years, lived and worked there for 2 years, moved back to Nigeria. In 2020, moved with my co-founders to Uyo, and we lived there for about 18 months. We moved to Abuja for 1 year, and then, we had to move to Lagos sometime last year because of the business. So that's been a very rushed summary.
Yeah, that's right. So why did you guys move to Uyo?
I think I've told this story a few times, but we were trying to minimize our cost and maximize our focus. It was also around when the pandemic started. So for us, it kind of was irrelevant where we were at the time because most people were indoors anyways. But we needed to minimize our personal burn and also spend time where we did not know anyone so we could really deepen the relationship we were building amongst ourselves. So now that I talk about it, it sounds like it was a very logical, thought-through process. But for us then, it was a very easy decision. It was clear. We needed to move somewhere. We audited about 5 cities. It wasn't going to be Lagos. It wasn't going to be Abuja. It definitely was not going to be Port Harcourt or Enugu. And Uyo was the next best thing on that list.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about Keeper. How is it going? How is building the all-in-one financial tool for small businesses in Nigeria going?
It's a journey that's filled with incredible learnings. We're building for a segment where there's been very little to no building for them historically. So there's no playbook to inherit. You kind of have to figure out and build a playbook for yourself. And the past 2 years of doing that has been filled with very incredible learnings. And we're going into the future of building the business armed with those learnings. The most important thing for us really has been getting deep, true understanding of who the Nigerian merchant is across the different rungs of the ladder, and what their psychographic needs are, and I would say that's something that we're still 2 years in. We're still learning every day, but I think that's the most important lever we have to pull: understanding what makes small businesses wake up every morning. Why do they wake up at 7 o'clock in the morning and work till 9 p.m. Monday to Saturday? Right. They barely take any breaks during the year, except for 2 weeks in December when most of them do. That's the pattern across multiple geographies, across multiple businesses. What is it that matters to them? And how can we position ourselves as the growth partner for them? And that's the most important thing. And, for us, it's an incredible learning journey, and we're building in line with those.
All right. Can you share some of your experiences? Because like you mentioned, the business segment, especially small businesses, majority of them don't exactly use technology in their day-to-day operations. I think a report stated about 70% of them don't use it. And some of them just say they do not think it's important. So what are some of the lessons you've learned in these 3 years running Keeper?
Well, you have to think of technology, not in the way you and I will think about it, right? When we say small businesses do not use technology or think of it as important, most small businesses, for example, use WhatsApp, Facebook, and Instagram to sell, to communicate with their suppliers and customers. So, you know, that's technology. You know, 50, 70 years ago, it was not a foregone conclusion that businesses needed electricity to operate. But now no business can really work without that. And that's the same way we think about software and technology, right? It's going to start with very simple, minimal functions like communication with suppliers and then payments, and then more complex needs that feed into the financial, for us, you know, as it's our concern, the financial management processes of small businesses. And as we've learned, and as most, you know, you probably know for sure, the financial management tasks of small businesses cut across different stakeholders, regulators, employees, suppliers, and customers. And so while today their use of technology probably touches mostly suppliers and customers at the very minimal level, there's a lot of room for that to be deepened and to build for the other stakeholders that they work with, but also bring all of those together. That's where we think the opportunity truly lies. So it's still very early, right? It's a very nascent market. But over the next 10 to 20 years, we know very clearly that the demand for technology tools, not just simple technology tools, but even more complex tech tools, will be on the rise.
Okay. So we talk a lot about investments on this podcast.
Yeah.
You've raised more than $11 million for Keeper. What was that experience like, considering this was your first time running a venture-backed startup? What was the experience like raising from investors?
Our fundraising process has happened, you know, across multiple rounds. But the first time we raised venture capital was in 2021, even before we launched the business. And as you know, I heard this from Shola, you know, of Paystack. As a founder, your job is to build your company, to build your business, and investors' jobs is to find you. I think it's cliche, and many people say, but it's cliche. Things are cliche for a reason, because it's so deeply true. You know, and it resonated when he said that. For the year before we started working on Keeper, we tinkered around with a bunch of different things, and you know, it was learning for us. We really did not settle on anything, and we tried to reach out to a few investors, and that did not really work out, right? But when we started to work on Keeper, we spent time, started to see significant traction. Somehow investors have their own internal tooling systems to find you. And so that first experience for us was really that. The very first investor who reached out to us, we had set up a Twitter page. He DM'd our Twitter page and did not get, we weren't really paying attention to it because it was just three of us, me and my two other co-founders. So we weren't really on our Twitter page. We didn't get the response to that. He went to our privacy policy on our website, found our privacy email. So it was something like privacy@keeper.africa. He sent an email to that email, like, please connect me with Kennedy or whoever the founders are. And that was how he reached out to us, and he's been one of our most supportive investors. So the point I'm trying to make is people, when the time is right, you know, investors will do their job and would, you know, move heaven and earth to try to meet you. So the first fundraising process, it took us about 3 months for us to, you know, talk with very many investors. You know, there were a bunch of mistakes that we made in that process, bunch of learnings. But thankfully, it went well, and we closed it in time to go back to focus on building the business.
Okay. How many investors did you speak to?
I don't remember now. It's somewhere. I'm sure if I open my laptop, I'll see a list. But definitely north of 70 investors, for sure.
All right.
Yeah.
So a lot of the VCs I speak to, they talk about the importance of building relationships with the founders, or founders not just cold emailing them and asking for a check immediately.
Yeah.
And I've heard you talk a lot about building professional relationships.
Yeah.
So what was that like for you? I know you mentioned the first investor reached out.
Yeah.
Not you reaching out to the person. So how has that been, like, you building relationships with investors, both potential and existing investors?
So it's a great question. I think at a very early stage, you know, at the pre-seed stage, for example, a lot of weighting, W-E-A-I-G-H-T-I-N-G, is not paid to how much relationship, historical relationship, because the, you know, ticket sizes are much smaller, the stakes are a lot lower. And that's from my experience. And to be very fair, very biased, raised our initial round at a time where the markets were really good and, you know, deals were closing in days or hours as opposed to weeks. So it wasn't my experience that a lot of priority was paid on historical relationships. But as a startup grows and matures, you see that relationship building becomes a lot more important, right? VCs want to fly down to meet you or want you to fly out to meet them. For those that are international, for those that are local, they want to spend more time, they want to meet your team. So that's very important. And once people come on board, you know, it's important that you start to identify those who you want to invest the most time building long-term relationships with. So from my perspective, for those who are trying to raise early, again, it's most important you spend time on your company and not fake optimizing by trying to build relationships too early with investors, because from my perspective, I think it's probably a bad look if you're spending more time building relationships than trying to, like, get your product out or spending more time with your customers. But as a company grows, the series A, B, C stages, I'm sure if you talk to founders who are even way ahead of me, you know, they'll tell you it's time to start to build long-term relationships with investors who you want to partner with, you know, over time.
All right. So for the investors that you finally went with, those who invested, how did you go about identifying them? So did you have, like, a framework that you used to decide who you are going to accept a check from?
It wasn't like there was way more money after hours than we wanted. And that's the experience of most African founders, to be honest with you. But we, of course, had multiple rounds of conversations with them. And in many ways, it was a mutual fit. After each of those conversations, my co-founders and I will be, what did you think? And the investors we liked the most are those who were able to prove practically how they could be of help to us at that time with the biggest problems on our mind. You know, in the earlier stages, it was the product. How do we design the product? How do we think about road mapping this product over the next 6 months? It was very tight, short timelines at the time. And we had this call, one call with an investor who, you know, was trying to get in after we had closed the round. But he, you know, it was, and he was very fun. He was able to show us, right? It was like a whiteboarding session, how he thinks the product potential should inform our roadmap over the next 6 months. And I was like, okay, we kind of like this guy. And we, you know, we brought he and his firm in after that. So I think that's probably the most important thing that was the most important thing for us at that phase of the business when we tried to figure out who to prioritize building a relationship with after bringing them in.
All right. So what were the most challenging parts of this process?
The process in and of itself is challenging, especially if you're doing it for the first time. You don't know what to expect. You don't know how long it's going to take. There's just a lot of unknowns. And for me, and I would say most founders who like to have control over things, over processes, it's just too many variables that are outside of your hand. So that in itself is, you know, is painful. But there's also the aspect of, you know, the due diligence. You know, that's a very complex process. I do not like paperwork stuff. Like, it's not my strongest strength. But it's a necessary evil I have to do. You know, so that in itself is not as exciting. I think another thing is also the context switching that happens, because you're now spending most of your time and headspace doing things that are not building your company. And so the fundraising process, think of it as a necessary evil. And is one I think CEOs have to get very good at, and over time really learn how to run a tight process around it. I don't think I'm the best at this by any stretch, but I definitely have learned important lessons that have helped me get better every time, with every interaction, to be honest.
Okay. So on one of my previous one of the previous podcast episodes, I was speaking to Neto, the founder of Wella Health.
Yeah, we work with Wella Health, actually.
Okay, awesome. So one of the questions I asked him was his thoughts around patient capital. So you hear startup founders in Africa talk about patient capital a lot. And I was curious about his own thoughts because he's very vocal about his experience as a founder. So what are your thoughts on the need for African founders to have patient capital or to receive patient capital for investors, especially considering that most of your investors are foreign investors?
Yeah.
I think just your angel investors are local. So how do you think about that?
I think it is absolutely necessary if you're building in this market. Like, think about our segment, right? If you're trying to build a generational business in this segment, it's a long-term game. You have to think about it on a multi-decade horizon. And you have to ensure your investors are on board. And I sent an email to one of the investors who passed on us during our seed round because I really like to, you know, get feedback. And the question I asked her was, what are the ways in which founders in Africa can help provide ongoing continuous education about what we need and what's happening on the market to investors across the world, right? Because I think the education bit of it, for a lot of people coming to the a lot of foreign investors coming to the African market very opportunistically. Okay, yeah, it's the last growth frontier. We missed out on India. We missed out on China. We don't want to miss out on Africa. But if you come in with that mindset, you're thinking about the whole thing wrong. And that mindset doesn't enable the sort of collaboration that is necessary to even unlock the potential that is in the that exists on the continent. So I think patient capital is very necessary. But beyond the capital itself being patient, it is impossible to get the sort of returns that we want to generate here if we don't have that patient, multi-decade horizon thinking. And I think that's absolutely necessary for anyone who's building here or investing in this market.
I'm curious, what was her response to your question?
I don't remember exactly what the words were, but one of the things, for example, you know, recommendations for she and I, our relationship was we have quarterly check-ins to just chat generally, you know, not asking, no one is asking anyone for anything, but to stay updated, to stay abreast. And I think that is also the relationship building aspect of things, where if there's multiple founders who are doing this with multiple investors, just talking about the market, getting feedback, you know, two-way feedback, you know, asking them what they're seeing, what their thoughts are, how the, you know, those who they're around are thinking about the market, and you providing them perspective. I think that provides some sort of shift over time in the interaction. I think the interactions are going to look very different. So it was something like that. It was just practical steps. We spend more time talking to each other now.
Okay. So looking back, having done at least two rounds of funding, what were some mistakes you made then that you think if you hadn't done them, maybe things would have turned out differently?
I don't think things would have turned out differently, right? Things turned out fine. The most important, so a lot of the mistakes were really like process and tactical mistakes, you know, structuring the round, for example, you know, saying yes before, you know, getting feedback from everyone you've spoken to. So it was just some of those tactical errors that most people make, you know, during initial rounds of fundraising. I'm spending more time with people who, you know, knowing what I know now, we're ultimately going to pass. And, you know, just like that intuition you build over time. So I think of them as necessary mistakes I had to learn, you know, during each of those conversations to get better. And when you're fundraising, you know, for the average round, you talk to north of 50 investors. So on each of those conversations, the first and the 50th conversation are very different. So with each conversation, with each person you speak to, with every time you have to pitch the company or answer questions about the company, it's just very different. You get better. You get you just get better overall. And that was our experience. So I don't think of them as mistakes that would have influenced the outcomes positively or negatively. I'm at peace with what the outcomes were. But you know, just necessary learning points.
Okay, so if you were to create your ideal investor, what qualities would that investor have?
Well, they will be investors who can go the long term with the company. So invest in multiple rounds, and people who have, or a person who has some sort of knowledge capital that they can, on an ongoing basis, you know, share with the company and really problem solve with them. An investor who does not get in the way of founders. So just be helpful in the way the founder wants you to be helpful, not the way you think you want to be helpful. I feel like the average investor is, you know, the averagely good investor is one who sends capital and just, you know, shuts up like after that, right? So for everyone who does anything else, you know, spends time on a monthly or quarterly basis with you, that's way above average. I think that's probably the rule of the investor. You help the founder in the way they want to be helped, be very proactive and responsive. Many investors are not that. So if anyone is doing that, you're already like in the top 10%, to be honest. Just get out of the way of founders and let them build and teach you and learn from them.
That response is kind of interesting, because I always assumed that you won't just send money. I assume that sending money is like the easiest part. So I always assumed an investor would like check in frequently with founders to like know what they're going through, knowing how they can help and doing their best to actually help them. But then you say the sending money is like the average, and then doing that you're way above average. That's like new.
Oh yeah. The investors do it, and the best of them figure out in what specific way they can be helpful beyond the generic how can I be helpful. Or let me know how I can be helpful. So the best investors learn that for themselves without you even telling them, right? Through their interactions with you, they understand where the gaps are and they plug those gaps by themselves. And I think that level of thoughtfulness is vanishingly rare.
Okay. All right. So you mentioned that you work with, Keeper works with Wella Health, and partnerships is something that I've seen a lot of startups get into. But sometimes it doesn't look like it's very evident what this partnership is set out to do. At least from the outside looking, it doesn't look very evident. So how do you navigate partnerships? How do you ensure that you're not just getting into partnerships because you want to be an ecosystem enabler? You actually want to build value for both yourself and your partner.
There's regulatory partnerships, there is product partnerships, there's financing partnerships. Like there's, you know, very different buckets for, like, at least at Keeper. There's always a very specific need we are trying to solve when we go out to seek a partnership, or when we say yes to a partnership proposal, you know, that's brought to us. And for us, the decision, making criteria here is, does this allow us to do our jobs easier and faster? And does it unlock value for our users? And if the answer is yes, then absolutely. That's how we make decisions for partnerships. But every partnership exists to solve a problem that we've pre-identified. And we're not as opportunistic with our partnerships. There's a very clear need, and we spell it out. We have multiple rounds of conversations with, you know, potential partners before we go into them.
Okay, so let's go back to Keeper for a bit. So in the last 2 to 3 months, we've had like major changes in Nigeria's economy, and it's affected the average person on the street. And I believe that also affects the businesses that serve them. How has that impacted? I know it's still early days, but how has that in any way impacted how you work at Keeper and how you work, especially because you work with small businesses? Has it impacted how you work with them?
It's been about 6 weeks, right? So we're still seeing the long-term permanent impacts firm up over time. But the cost of doing business has at least doubled for the average. I mean, for us too, I'm sure for your business too. The cost of doing business for the average SMB has doubled. The granularity when it comes to their cash flow management and profitability now more than ever is critical to them. And that's where tools like Keeper come in, right? Helping them keep track of their financial management tasks and stay on top of that in a way that they historically have not been able to. Because now more than ever, it's important. This is one of the worst times to be a small business owner in Nigeria, for sure, at least in the past 20 years. So we will continue to listen to our users, spend time with them, observe what the long-term impact of the policy changes we've seen will be on them, and then build in, to solve their most critical needs at the time.
All right. So how do you think about competition? Because especially in the space for businesses solving the needs of small businesses, it's getting a little bit more competitive. But on the other hand, we also have it's, how do I explain this? It's a bit difficult as well. So we've had startups shut down that were previously serving this segment. And we also have a newcomers getting into this space. And I know you're a very competitive person. How does that play into the way you lead your team at Keepa?
Yes, I'm a very competitive person. And that's something I've had to learn how to manage, especially with how we're building Keepa. At the point where the competition is the reason why your startup is doing badly, congratulations, right? You've gotten to a point where you're probably a market leader and there's one or two others who are squeezing market share from you. But when you look at it, all startups are really running different experiments. There's definitely no clear winner yet. And we do not spend time at the business world. I don't distract my team with that at all, right? We know our users. We every day we learn more about what it is they want, understanding, like I said earlier, their psychographic needs. And we think whoever will win is going to be a byproduct of doing that, serving them, building for them, ensuring that we're doing that in a way that's profitable, right? Pricing our products at the right nanometer scale. Like, all of those things would, inform, like, that is us competing in and of itself. So I don't think too much about, it's also a question that we get asked a lot when we meet investors. Oh, how are you different from this, 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 and this? And it's a question that makes sense to ask, but I do not think the market is at the point now where competition can kill any startup. All of the startups that have shut down did not shut down because of competition, right? And we are not going to see any startups that would die because of competition over the next 10 years, I am very sure. And when we get to that point as an ecosystem, wow, we've crossed the first hierarchy of, needs, and we're on to the next. And that's something we should be very proud of. So that's not something I spend a lot of time distracting my team with at all.
All right. So what's your leadership style like?
I don't know. I don't know that I have a style, to be honest. In many ways, right from when I was, really young, I've held different leadership positions, informal and informal capacity. And so I think it's been very honed. It's been honed from that. But the most important thing for me as a leader that I try to do, and I think this is the what it means to be at the brunt of leadership, is not being afraid to stare into the abyss. And what I mean by that is asking yourself the hard questions that everyone knows for sure, but no one wants to ask, right? It's almost like that thing, the answer that you want is exactly where you don't want to look. So as a leader, for me, it is forcing everyone to look at those things that we would naturally shy away from looking at. But every other thing, I think, is intrinsic to my personality, even outside of Keepa or before Keepa. And with the people who I work with, I try to, you have to lead everyone differently. So one style doesn't work for everyone. You manage different people differently. And so it's just like staying, abstracting one level above and staying very flexible with how you manage people.
Okay. So what's the size of your team?
Today we're about 70 people.
Right. In the last 2 years of leading Keepa, what are some tips you have for founders who are just starting their first businesses?
Everyone says this, but it's so important that the team you hire is, especially the first few people who join the team, that you're you pay a lot of attention to that, like spend a lot of time before you make those decisions. And when you bring them in, try to keep them in for as long as possible. And what that means is you also have to develop your taste when it comes to talent. And I read something along the lines of B players hire C players. And that's always going to be the case. I've seen it play out so many times, and it's terrible. So figure out ways to make yourself an A player. That way your taste when it comes to talent quality is very high and the bar is higher. And you're someone who understands how to attract the best people, because, you know, A players will never come work for a B player, especially early on. Maybe when you have some reputation, if you do, they will. But early on, no A player will come work for a B player. And if you're not able to attract A players early on, then it's hard to see how you'll win against those who have A players. So I think that's probably the most important thing. The others are just more personal, right? When you're thinking about starting a business, make decisions quickly. No matter how difficult they are, make them very quickly. Once you figure them out, you may be wrong, but even if you're wrong, you've integrated some sort of new knowledge piece into your knowledge structure. And that way you're sharpening your gut. That way you can make decisions faster. When you encounter similar situations, you already have mental models that allow you make decisions around things like that in the future. So that's very important, to make decisions quickly and hone your gut. The other is, I guess the third and final thing I would say is don't be afraid of failure. Because, and this is something I'm also learning for myself. And when I say failure, I do not mean, you know, the big catastrophic failure, but even that too. As a founder of a business, you know all the things that are going wrong. And if your ego, I read this recently, if your ego cannot, or if your reputation cannot handle a bruise, maybe we had a bad month or we had a bad quarter, then your reputation is worth nothing anyway. So don't be afraid of things like that. The journey is definitely non-linear, and you have to get very good at communicating bad news to yourself, to your employees, to all other stakeholders, and not allowing that debilitate you. I think that's very, very, very important. A lot of people don't talk enough about how building a startup is. It is very personal, right? A journey of insane personal discovery that you have to manage very well for the business to succeed. Think very deeply about what it is you want to do in the world. I personally do believe that we're all put on earth for something very unique. And it's not necessarily like what you choose to do, right? But the overarching purpose for why we're put on earth is to manifest a certain type of potential that leaves certain type of impact in the world, and figure out if what you're trying to do is an appropriate vehicle at this moment in your life for you to leave that impact in the world. And impact in the world doesn't have to be anything grandiose. For most people, it's, I need to take care of my family. I need to be a good brother, a good son, a good father, and all of those. Like, that maybe is your purpose, right? To nurture those people who are most closely around you. For some others, it is, you know, I'm going to conquer all of Earth, right? I'm going to be Alexander the Great. And, you know, that's, so figure out what it is for you, and do not imitate the passions of other people, you know, because it looks rosy. Most times it's really not. So spend a lot of time and get comfortable with yourself, become one with yourself, and single-mindedly focus on doing the work that you've been put on earth.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. Cheers.